It's all fun and games until someone pops a vocal cord trying to imitate Nathan Queen on the Fish Golf Broadcast. On this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, I'm welcoming someone who very unwisely got into disc golf about 6 months after Amateur Worlds was held 20 minutes from his hometown. It's Nathan Johnson. Nathan, what you thinking about?
That is one of the greatest regrets I have joining the sport, was learning that I missed out on an Am Worlds an hour from my hometown.
Whoops. So I've had folks on who found disc golf during COVID, but most of those were still relative children when they did. And you were largely a fully formed adult when you discovered disc golf in 2020.
A part of me wishes that I was a child when I discovered disc golf, but then the wiser part of me realizes that I probably would have gotten really frustrated really quickly as a child and given up on it. So in a way, I am glad that I found it as an adult, but, and it was for many people, the perfect pandemic kind of hobby.
What about disc golf or your personality would have kind of muddied the waters as a child and made you run away screaming?
I think as a child, and not just a child, through high school, I mean, I was a very competitive person. I still am. I've just learned how to contain it a little more. But yeah, I got frustrated easily, especially when it came to sports, and I tied a lot of my happiness when it comes to sports to the results. Mm-hmm. I was the kind of teammate who would yell at my teammates if they weren't doing well, and like, it took me 17 years until pretty much my senior year of high school to realize that other people didn't like that when you're not encouraging to them as a teammate in team sports. So I think I probably would have taken out a lot of that frustration on my discs and or hopefully, but probably card mates.
Okay. What sports were you playing at the time?
I've tried at least pretty much every sport known to man at mm-hmm. some point. For a significant amount of time, I played baseball for like 10 years up until basically high school. And then I wasn't going to make my high school's baseball team because I just wasn't quite good enough. And that's when I transitioned to volleyball. And then I conveniently grew 6 inches between my freshman and sophomore years of high school, which is great if you're trying to play volleyball.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, I kind of realized I was tall, and that was made that transition a lot easier. So I played volleyball for pretty much 10 years, another 10 years through college, not competitively, because at Penn State, they have a very good men's volleyball team.
People who are taller and bouncier than you, probably.
Yes, I'm short. As a 6'2 man, I'm short in volleyball terms, yes. But yeah, I played volleyball, and then during the pandemic, you need other people to play volleyball. So I chose a sport that didn't require other people.
Sure. So you said at 17, you realized that other teammates didn't really care for your motivational strategies.
That's a good way to put it.
How did you figure that out? Did somebody sit you down or what?
I do remember a moment. It was my junior year. We lost in the quarterfinal or semifinal of our league volleyball end of year tournament. And I remember during that game just being furious, like a lot of yelling. I remember a specific moment where like one of my teammates had messed up a play during the game, and I like turned to my coach on the sideline and yelled something along the lines of like, give me like whatever the other guy on the bench's name was. Like, I need him, like me, like I was playing setter. And so in volleyball, if those aren't familiar, like I'm the guy who's basically like the point guard in basketball, right? I'm dishing out the assist to other players. And I don't know, for some reason I had taken it very like personally of like, wow, how could my teammate do this to me? Like he's, you know, I don't know. It was a very interesting mindset. But after that game, like, I don't know if anybody specifically told me, maybe my coach and I had a conversation about it, but I realized like I was not a pleasant teammate to be around.
My impression would be that you want the setter to be like calm and precise. You'd want a hitter to be like that fiery.
Yes. The take out the aggression on the ball kind of guy. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I ideally should be, you know, I was a captain on the team, but I probably shouldn't have been looking back.
It was just because time. You were old and good?
Yeah. I mean, I was good. I was also old, but I was only a junior. Like, there were other seniors with a lot more experience than me on the team. I think I was a leader, but not in like in that Tom Brady way where he just like would go off on guys on the bench, which I think in football is probably great. Volleyball, not so much. But yeah, my senior year, I kind of like realized that, and I tried to be a little bit better teammate, a little more encouraging, a little more open. Because at that point, I was the old guy on the team, and we had a lot younger team.
So that's a really big, broad, abstract goal. What are tactile ways that you tried at the time or that you can look back and see worked to be a better leader on that team?
Yeah, I think it was more about like trying to be friends and liked and likable with my teammates. I rather than seeing them as just like pawns or, you know, assets to the team, but as like people and being encouraging. These are things that I try to bring to my disc golf game now. Like I make the joke a lot of the time that like I bring my card mates a 20 point rating increase by just from the good vibes when I'm on a card with them. I don't know if that's actually true. There's no data to back that up, but it is something that I try to do on the disc golf course. In Pennsylvania, I'm not going to name names. And sometimes on the pro tour, there are some guys that are quite unpleasant to play with at times. And I kind of see that on the course, and it is my worst nightmare to be perceived that way now after, you know, growing up and knowing that people perceived me that way. You know, just being encouraging, being lighthearted, not trying to take myself too seriously is something that I have been really striving for recently.
You found the pivot. That's kind of where I was going to go with this, because in volleyball or another team sport, you've got your off season, you've got the season, you have practices and your games and your tournaments. And in all cases, like, you're hitting the weight room, you're hitting the gym with your teammates, and you're pushing each other, and you're figuring out, you know, the strategies to understand somebody's body positioning in order to like get the best result that you can. In disc golf, you don't really have that. Like, it's all your own motivation to go practice. And occasionally you might have a friend who can help be a little bit of a swing coach, or you might have a caddy who can, you know, be a good vibe check. But when it comes down to doing it, you've got 30 seconds, your own brain and your own skill.
It's quite an adjustment as someone, again, this is pretty much the first individual sport I've played competitively in my life. And it's a different mindset to be your own coach and your own teammate and your own, you know, even though there are card mates and there are, you know, now we have teams that are sponsorship teams, right? Those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, you're the only one that is deciding how the outcome is for yourself, right?
I like your description of, you know, being a 20-point ratings bump. I asked the folks at StatMando if they could try to track something like that throughout this year. And I don't know if they are. I don't know if they had the time to, you know, write a little Python script
for
it or
something. They
might
have better things to do.
But maybe you're the software engineer who needs to track what cards people play on. And maybe there's some confounding factors here. Like, the people who end up on lead card, well, if you were lucky enough or good enough to be playing above your head and you jumped onto the lead card to play with Calvin, well, it probably means that Calvin's not the reason that you're playing above your rating. It's because you're having a really good weekend. I have said for close to 10 years now that every time I play with Eric Smith, man, I'm going to play so good. I know I'm going to play so good because, like, he is going to make me laugh three times a hole.
I like to think the same thing, but I also played with Zach Melton yesterday, well, as we're recording this, yesterday. And he made me laugh the whole time, but I played horribly. So maybe there isn't a correlation between the laughter. But also 2 weeks ago, I've had some great card mates at an A tier. I played in Pennsylvania, played well there. So who knows? Maybe there's no correlation. Maybe there is. We'll have to let StatMando decide.
I think there is correlation between your ability to laugh and, as you stated, not take yourself too seriously. In volleyball, just like in disc golf, the more tense you are, the more pressure you feel that yourself or others are exerting, the harder it is to like calm down and relax and throw the good shot.
It's true. Yeah, there's the mental game of disc golf is probably the hardest part, the hardest thing I've had to adjust to, right? Like, especially also every team sport I played growing up, I figured would translate well, like the mindset of, you know, being an athlete and then starting to play disc golf, right? Especially now that I'm trying to play on the pro tour and at these bigger events. But almost none of it does, especially the reactionary sports, right? Like baseball is probably the closest thing that I have mentally to disc golf, but like volleyball, I don't have to think at all during the game because
you can't. It's
somebody hits a ball 80 miles per hour at my face, maybe not 80, but very fast, and I just go, right? It's all reactionary.
Yeah.
And disc golf, I have way too much time to think about the putt that I'm lining up, right? Some people have more time than others on the putts they're lining up, but you know, trying to find that balance of like, how much do I want to think about this, right? You know, when you're laughing and having a good time, there's less thoughts, right? Ideally, which for most people seems to be a good thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's a learning curve.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're originally from Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Correct. You said it right too. Bonus points.
Yeah. Can you give some examples of the wrong way to say it?
Lancaster is the most common. Because I don't know if this is true because I've never been there, but I've heard that there is a Lancaster, California, but it is, for the record, officially, it is Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Two syllables real quick and then one.
Correct. Mm. Yes.
Okay. And the first course that you played was Overlook Park. And I had the distinct unpleasure of playing that this winter.
Why?
I like playing courses and it made geographic sense for where I was going. And I don't think I'm ever going to do it again. I don't remember what it's rated. I don't really use the rating systems.
It's overrated, whatever the rating is.
Whatever the fuck it is. Like, it's pretty flat. There's occasional trees, but
there's like 6 good holes at the end.
The problem is that there's 12 more. Mm-hmm. And the front nine is undergoing a redesign, and there's one hole that you play and then backtrack the entire length of that to Correct. Go play an equally featureless hole. Why? So that's the first course you played and you didn't quit?
That's a great point. Yeah, I probably should have. I mean, I didn't even play a full round. Mm. I'll tell you the day. It was April 14th, 2020 was my first round of disc golf at Overlook Park. Me and my dad went out, played 12 holes. I think we got tired and or frustrated after that.
Navigating?
Navigating is difficult because, yeah, in the old layout, like you mentioned, they're redesigning it currently. In the old layout, there's 6 holes. There's a front 6 and a back 12. And the two are separated by a fairly long walk, probably half a mile. So we played the back 12 without knowing that the front 6 existed. My dad, I think, played with an ultimate disc, a lid. And I think I had a starter set that my brother used in middle school and, you know, the classic story. But yeah, no, luckily, I don't think I knew any better that was the only course that we knew of, which if you've ever been to Lancaster, there are a bunch of really great courses that everybody should check out. As Fish mentioned, there was NAMM Worlds very close by in 2019. So
I'm going to correct the record. Hosting an AM Worlds does not necessarily mean that the courses are good. Okay, let's move on.
Yes. But yes, there are good courses and they hosted an AM Worlds. We'll say those are two unrelated things.
I appreciate the software programmer in you just like capital A-N-D.
Yeah.
In there.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. We're using Boolean expressions here on the podcast today for those at home. I don't even know where I was going. Yeah. No, that was my first round. And I think I was frustrated enough. I am the kind of person that thinks that if I put enough effort into something, I can be really good at it. Like, maybe to a fault. So when I started disc golf and I was really bad at it, like I had no frisbee experience before disc golf. I played maybe one semester of ultimate in college, but I only could ever throw forehands. I could not throw a backhand, like normal frisbee throw to save my life. So the fact that I was so bad at disc golf, I figured if I put enough work into this, I could actually be decent. So it was more, I think it was out of spite that I came back. If that right. answers your question.
I admire that. Like, spite fueling motivation. That's big time.
It's powerful.
Yeah. So why did you keep with something that you were bad at? If you'd fancy yourself a fairly athletic person growing up playing baseball, volleyball, I'm sure you played basketball and could shoot pool, whatever. Like, yeah. There's a pretty low skill threshold to getting into a lot of things. Disc golf if you can't spin a disc, it's a really high skill threshold.
Yeah, it is. I think I've heard somebody use the analogy before with skiing and snowboarding, that skiing is easy to learn, hard to master, and snowboarding is hard to learn, but easy to master. I think disc golf
is... Do you ski or snowboard?
I ski, but I do not snowboard. I can't do this 2 feet on the same thing. That scares me. But if my feet are not connected, then we're good.
Okay.
But I think disc golf is kind of similar. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I just went off the rails. But like it was tough to learn a backhand. Like I've started in the YouTube era, so I had lots of resources to help me, but also there's also a lot of bad resources out there, so maybe hurt me at the same time. But yeah, to self-teach myself how to throw a frisbee backhanded was a lot of work and a lot of the, you know, all the things that people say, film yourself and then you look at it and then you try to figure it out again. But yeah, it was really frustrating. Like my first, you know, I could figure out a forehand just because I think most athletic people that have played throwing type sports can kind of figure that out early on.
At some level, you're also just like dropping your arm angle from a serve.
Yeah. Yeah. I played a little tennis too. It's very similar to volleyball motions. Like it translates from a lot of sports. So that wasn't too hard to figure out. But yeah, the backhand was just like, especially even as a baseball player, it's a lefty swing, right? Like I'm a right-handed batter, so it's the opposite of what I'm used to. Mm-hmm. So there's really nothing that translates to throwing a frisbee. So it took me a long time. I figured out kind of the smooth backhand form now in my game, but I still haven't quite figured out the distance backhand, that extra gear of, you know, really sending a frisbee is something that I'm still working on. So
sure. So in a nutshell, could you describe what your disc golf game is for listeners who may not have heard of or seen you play?
My game revolves around being able to throw both spins really well inside of 400 feet is like my bread and butter right now.
Built for the 90s.
I know. I watch old coverage and I'm like, oh, if I could have played these courses at Pro Tours, it would have given me, I wouldn't have had a great time. I mean, well, I don't know. The disc technology was different back then. I wouldn't have been able to like really crank on forehands like I can now. But I'd like to think I have a pretty good touch forehand game too. So I think I could have made it work. But especially being in Charlotte now, the flip up woods game, you know, like the game a lot of people see Jerm have now is like what I aspire to pull off. And I think I've made a good progress towards it. But yeah, if all Pro Tours had, you know, I didn't have to throw more than 400 feet, I would be in a great spot. But unfortunately, that's not where the game is currently.
Alas. And what's a round or two that folks should check out to see you playing your game?
Yeah, there's a couple of rounds of myself playing on Heiser Media. If you haven't checked out their YouTube channel, they film a lot of disc golf on the East Coast, and occasionally you'll get to listen to me doing commentary.
That's where I know your voice from.
Yes, yes, yes. You may have heard me on commentary on there as well. Yeah, I've got a couple of good rounds on there. Don't watch my first ever round on coverage. I do miss a 7-foot putt as
Hell
my first
yeah.
ever putt
Hell
on
yeah.
coverage. Parked the hole, missed a 7-footer into the cage. So, you know, yeah, you can skip past that part, and then yeah, there's a couple of good rounds on me on there.
I'm Matt Bell, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I fish.
I'm Kyle Klein, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I go fishing.
You know, I spent all of season one in this very ad break saying that we would never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads. But lately, I've had a change of heart. The integrity of this show absolutely has a price. We're talking lakehouse money. Private island money. Lakehouse on a private island money. But until that hypothetical benevolent corporate overlord speaks up, though, this show is entirely supported by your support of me and my sponsors. Fish Stamp Discraft discs are available in-store and online at daddydiscgolf.com, dischub.com, and treemagnets.com. and fishdiscgolf.com when I'm not traveling. You can save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10 at checkout, unless you're a fool who likes spending full price on disc golf bags. And of course, our name is derived from Disc Golf Bra, whose media channels and website you should visit for outstanding New England content. And now, more mutual hostility between Fish and the guest. Nathan, how do you start your videos on Instagram?
Well, I mean, first I start with a catchy little opening because you got to draw the people in.
Absolutely. Right?
But then after the catchy little opening, it's, I'm Nathan, and this is my journey to becoming a professional disc golfer.
Cool. So you started at Overlook Park and you couldn't fucking throw.
Yep.
And now you are competing regionally at A-tiers and occasionally popping onto the Pro Tour. You made kind of the concerted career choice, given your actual job, your actual day job, to move to Charlotte, North Carolina for greater competition, density of courses, better weather. What went into all of that?
Yeah, it was an all of the above kind of thing. You know, I'd been in Pennsylvania my whole life, 20, 25 years, for growing up, college, and then after college, since I graduated during a pandemic, ended up staying around for a little longer than I wanted. And yeah, it was time to leave. No offense to my parents who graciously let me stay with them for a couple of years after.
Who did your laundry while you lived there?
We need to cut this part out, Andrew. No, I know my mom, my mother is a wonderful woman. She cooked me many, many delicious meals, did my laundry. Wow, this is turning into a direction I didn't expect.
That's the goal on the Fish Golf Broadcast.
But yeah, it was time to go. And that's part of the reason. I needed to do my own laundry. And yeah, I moved to Charlotte. I work remotely, so it's kind of, you know, when you can move literally anywhere in the world, it's actually kind of hard to make a decision on where you want to end up.
So you got a degree in what?
I have a degree in computer science and math from Penn State.
Okay, total fucking nerd.
Yep.
And you're now working for whom?
I don't know. Can I say? Should I say? I work for Microsoft.
It's up to you. And that job was fully remote when you started or got transitioned to fully remote because of the pandemic?
Correct. Yeah, it wasn't supposed to be. I was supposed to move to Seattle after I graduated college, but then I graduated in literally May of 2020. So.
Right. And well, moving to Seattle would have been an even bigger trope. So maybe it's a good thing that you didn't.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have found disc golf if I did. So that's for sure.
Can you talk about what a typical week looks like for you when you're trying to play a Pro Tour event? Like, let's say that you have three rounds, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and you've got to squeeze in your practice rounds around work. What does that week look like for you?
Yeah, it's a lot. Like, we'll just go through last week, give some inside baseball here. We're filming this the day after Jonesboro. So I'll talk about my week for Jonesboro. The week before, I was playing an A-tier in Pennsylvania. So that is 14 hours away. So I left literally after my final round at the A-tier. It was like 2 p.m. in the afternoon, started driving to Jonesboro. I got about 8 hours in that day. So then I got a hotel, stayed overnight, and then I have to work because it's Monday. So I worked from the hotel for as long as I could until they kicked me out. Then I found like a Starbucks or like a Panera, whatever, wherever I can get some Wi-Fi, worked the rest of my day, and then drove the other 6.5 hours to Jonesboro Monday night. And then Tuesday is kind of like a normal day for me on when I'm on the Pro Tour. I work my 9 to 5. Luckily we're in central time, so my 9 to 5 is actually 8 to 4. So I'm able to get out around 4 o'clock to the course, play my practice round. Ideally, I get in a full round before dark. Luckily, most pros are playing their rounds earlier, so there's not too many people on the course that late. And then, yeah, I just do it all again the next day. Luckily, another reason I can't play every Pro Tour, one, because I'm working, but two, just I can't take off every single Friday, or sometimes it's Thursday and Friday. So, you know, kind of have to be strategic about the events I play. I usually play just the ones, at least as of now, that I can drive to, because that's just the most feasible way to do it. But I mean, right now I'm in a little three tournament mini tour with Jonesboro Music City and Champions Cup next week. So it's a lot. It's kind of exhausting mentally and physically. My practice rounds aren't necessarily the most productive just because I am doing it after a day of work, and I'm just kind of like, don't really want to be out there sometimes. But when you only have a chance to play like maybe 3 days, maybe two rounds, depending on when I get into town, just have to kind of make the most of the opportunities I get.
Sure. I certainly identify with that. And I've played Pro Tours or NTs when those still existed. I played those blind sometimes and then leave right after my round and get back to Baltimore at 2 a.m. and then get up at 7 and go to work. It's a, it's quite a struggle. And you're a little bit of an anachronism among players who are playing at this level.
Yeah, I don't know what anachronism means because I'm a math guy, not a reading guy. I mean, I would love to quit my job and do disc golf full time. But as a non-tour card holder and aspiring pro, it's not really feasible for me to do now. So I'm kind of in that like in between phase where I'm just kind of figuring out, testing the waters of, is this something that I could maybe do full time? My results so far say no, but I also realize I'm still new to this sport. So, you know, hopefully over time, I'll have more of a reason to make the jump.
Sure. And at a minimum, you kind of have the safety net of full-time job.
It is nice. The salary part is a nice side.
Yeah, you're going to cash this week, aren't you?
I cash every week, yeah. Whether or not I play well on disc golf. This is true.
Yeah, that's the tremendous advantage of doing it that way. Mm-hmm. And having a remote job, like you say, it means that you can live wherever. And, I mean, you can play a B-tier Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah. Yeah, it is nice. And I mean, Charlotte's a great place to have that option too, right? Of like, there's plenty of tournaments going on down there.
So when you were deciding where to move from Pennsylvania, because you wouldn't mow the lawn, you wouldn't do your own laundry.
Yes, my parents kicked me out. Yes.
Yeah. How did you land on Charlotte? And where else was under consideration?
I've given a lot of different answers for this, but I think
you can tell the truth or the best answer.
Yeah. I think disc golf is one of the main reasons. For most people that ask me, I don't tell them that because they would frown upon that answer. But for this audience, I think they will understand my answer. So I can tell the truth here. Now, there were a couple different reasons. I definitely knew I wanted to move south for the warmth and slightly longer daylight during the winters and curing my seasonal depression and all those things. I was looking at I don't want a big city, but something sizable with people around. And one of my friends that I was moving with, current roommate, he was also looking at kind of North Carolina. He was actually looking at Asheville. I was able to convince him to come to a more disc golf centric city in North Carolina, in Charlotte. So it ended up working out. I'm really happy with the move. I've been there. I mean, I say I've been there as I'm not there currently, but off and on, I've been there since July of last year, so it worked out.
Sure, and that's a pretty good jumping off point to Eastern North Carolina. You've got good number of tournaments in Tennessee. You'll be very close to Worlds next year for Lynchburg.
Oh yeah.
Upstate South Carolina has a lot of tournaments. If you go 4 hours south to Atlanta, you can get an A-tier or two. Is it a better or worse tournament and course scene than being in central Pennsylvania?
Man, you're putting me on the spot. I'm going to make some people angry depending on how I answer this question. I got to put my politician hat on. I wouldn't say it's better or worse, honestly.
Bullshit. This is unbelievable.
I think it's different. It's especially the courses, for sure, right? Like central Pennsylvania has a lot of park-style courses, there are not a lot of open courses, not a lot of fully wooded courses. It's a lot of, you know, you have to shape shots, but they're very scrambleable, not very tight woods, right? The woods are all very fair, or at least in Lancaster especially.
And a lot of hardwoods.
Yes, yes. Charlotte is very tight. Like the Charlotte Golf is, for folks that are listening that have not played it, it is as advertised, especially like Nevin and Hornet's Nest and Angry Beaver. Like these courses from the longs play... even is well over 1,000 rated, and it is that for a reason, right? And I like it. Like, that's my style of golf. Like, the harder the course, at least wooded style of golf, the better, in my opinion. Like, I'm very much excited to go back to Northwoods Black in 2 weeks because I think that's the style of golf that I can, you know, excel at. So, not that I have anything against Pennsylvania golf. I went back there 2 weeks ago for an A-tier, right? Because I do like those style of courses too. But the Charlotte scene...
I think he went back for a C-tier.
But the... Yeah, I mean, yeah, as Hammer called it, a C-tier with... Or not Hammer. As Dylan and I called it, it was a C-tier with more added cash. But we won't talk about that today. But yeah, no, I've liked the transition to Charlotte and the more wooded golf has been good.
What have you... learned in Charlotte that you were not able to learn about your disc golf game playing in other regions?
It has forced me to figure out how to hit gaps with backhands. Not that there aren't courses that force you to hit gaps with backhands in Pennsylvania, but it's really dialed in my confidence in my backhand game. I was definitely, for the first 3 years of my disc golf career, anytime there was a gap, I was going to force a forehand in Pennsylvania. And there are a lot of forehand type shot gap shots in Charlotte. As again, if you watch Germ or any of these Charlotte guys' games, you can understand why. But yeah, it's really helped me kind of dial in my gap hitting and just having confidence going to a more variety of shots off the tee. Hyzer flips, like those, I never had to throw hyzer flips in Pennsylvania. Everything you could just throw overstable discs flat and then have them fade out and it would work. Or at least the courses I played. Down here, if you don't have a hyzer flip game both ways, you are going to be in for a long day and a lot of scrambling. So it's been a good learning experience.
Okay, maybe conversely, if your stated goal is to be a professional disc golfer, what have you learned on the Disc Golf Pro Tour that maybe you didn't anticipate or has made you focus on a different skill than you focused on when you initiated that goal?
I don't know if there's anything yet that I've learned that I didn't already know, but it definitely confirmed some of my suspicions about how my game would translate. I mean, obviously, I think I mentioned it earlier. The biggest thing is distance that I'm missing right now. And it's not like the thing about distance on the Pro Tour is not that I can't reach holes necessarily. There are a couple holes at Jonesboro that I need to throw a perfect shot to reach, but I could reach them. I can throw a 450 plus foot shot, but I have to throw an understable disc on like a max distance line. Whereas courses like that don't shape for those kind of shots. Like you have to be able to throw an overstable disc 450 or 500 feet.
Yeah, you get a calm practice day and damn, right, you're out there scoring. But sorry, buddy, people are going to go shoot 15 in those conditions, not 7.
Exactly. So yeah, it's not that you have to be able to throw 500 feet as a number, you know, to compete on the Pro Tour. It's that you have to be able to throw 600 feet so that when you throw your 500 foot shots, it's way more reliable than my 500 foot shots, which I don't necessarily know if it's going to fade out at the very end or if it's going to hold Anheuser the whole way because there's a 20 mile per hour crosswind that I'm throwing into. So yeah, it's been a learning experience, maybe more a little more frustrating, but at the same time, like I know where I lack and I know where I need to put in the work.
How do you go about designing a plan to improve those skills?
Yeah, I made a short Instagram video about this earlier this year because, like I said, I had suspicions. I hadn't played Jonesboro or this week we're going to play Music City, two, you know, notably long open courses on the Pro Tour. And, you know, you watch coverage and you see 480 foot par threes and you're like, are those really 480 foot par threes? And then you get here and they are 480 foot feet slightly uphill par threes.
Right. Like this. Okay. You've heard about this up and comer, right? Mm-hmm. He's playing AM2 and he throws 480 feet.
Yep.
Through his star katana.
Exactly.
But then you get paired with him in doubles and you're thinking, all right, this guy might help me a little bit.
Yeah.
And he gets a hold of one, but he throws it into the next county.
Right.
Sideways. Misses every putt. And that 480 was only achieved on the most downhill hole in Lancaster.
Right, exactly. Ugh. I mean,
worthless.
Yes. I wouldn't say worthless. I love all those kids. And there are multiple of them in Lancaster that absolutely rip.
And tell you that they rip.
But they tell you they rip, yeah. I don't think they're going to, no offense to them, but I don't think they're going to score well out here at this side of heaven. So, but yeah, for me, and I don't either because I struggle because I can't throw an overstable disc far enough. So yeah, there were three things basically I said in the video, which was number one, I have to go to the gym. I'm too scrawny. And it's not like, you know, you have to be Ezra Aderholt to throw far, right? Like we see guys like Gannon and AB who are leaner builds that can throw really far. But at the same time, those guys are still pretty strong, right? Like, they just look skinny because they're 6'6". So, you know, like, yeah, hitting the gym was step number one. I think I need to be a little more intentional about, like, the things I do there. But that's a story for another day. Field work was something that I struggle with because it's just, like, can be very boring at times and hard to motivate yourself to go out there and just rip shots without, you know, I'm a competition guy. I need a game. I need a, you know, something to shoot for. So just like throwing without purpose or seemingly without purpose is tough for me, but I've been trying to get better about it. And then form tweaks, like overall, I'm pretty happy with my form. I think there are some things that I could do. My form is built very well for the Charlotte and the Lancaster disc golf style of golf, which means that I never have to throw full power. I can throw like 60 to 80%, and which gets me to about 400 feet, which can birdie me almost every single hole in at not a non-pro tour course, at any non-pro tour course in the world. But I haven't figured out how to like throw harder, you know, and make it work well. So, you know, I think rather than like actually changing my form, it has to be, it's more of like a mental thing of how do I just get the disc to come faster out of my hand when I want it to, which is easier said than done.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a tremendous process to get your like hips and plant foot to trust all of that force. You can improve that in the gym, but then like the kids who throw really far, they've been doing that since they were 7. They didn't have the like adult fears of, man, I really like my ACL the way it is.
Yeah. And the thing is too, right? Like you said, like the kids that are doing it when they're 7, if we look at all the guys, and this is, you know, something I've thought about, if we look at all the guys who have great disc golf, you know, the quote unquote perfect disc golf form, right? Like the Simons and Paul Macbeth, like these guys that people model their backhand form after, none of them had YouTube when they were starting, right? They just went into a field and threw a bunch of times, or at least this is what they say when they get interviewed, right? They just went into a field and threw a bunch of times until it worked, right? So, you know, not that it's not a good thing to just, you know, film yourself and work on your form and try to tweak things, but you don't have to do that, right? It seems the evidence is that the human body will kind of figure it out if you do something enough. So, you know,
you see the same thing with baseball stances, right? And basketball shooters,
like, yeah, there are some funky shots out there in in basketball, but and they work. Some of them work.
Yeah, you can get, you know, coaching academies that converge everyone to the same meta, mm-hmm. but it's more, to me, it's more fun and interesting when there are the outliers out there. Yeah. I have a question for you about, let's say, the states of Pennsylvania and Maryland and Delaware and New Jersey.
Okay. The Mid-Atlantic, quote-unquote.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a time when Nockamixon, kind of northeastern Pennsylvania, was churning out some really solid players. Like, mm-hmm. they had Devin Frederick and Mike Carman and Hank Hendry and, you know, a few other guys who comprise a very awful team for the Virginia Team Invitational.
Speaking of which, can I use this opportunity? I want to play VTI so bad. I still haven't. Charlotte, I don't know if it's the Charlotte team or the Pennsylvania. I feel like I can fall into multiple boats now. Somebody please recruit me. I want to be in for next year. You can continue now.
Open pandering. Disgusting. Yes. Well, I guess that's how we find out what captains listen to this. And
exactly. I'll let you know.
Need somebody. I've long been the only Maryland disc golfer on the Pro Tour. And at some level, I consider myself an Atlanta guy since that's where I started playing. Like, my style is more informed by Atlanta woods than anything in the Mid-Atlantic. Dylan Horst has occasionally popped onto the Pro Tour. Nobody from Pittsburgh, as far as I know, has ever been 1,000 rated, which is astonishing given that they've had Worlds and NTs and long-running A-tiers and great courses.
Yeah.
What is it about our region, whether it's courses or competition or some other factor I haven't considered, that isn't churning out Pro Tour ready players?
That's a really good question. I really don't know.
Is it because they don't want it enough?
Yes, that is the answer. Pennsylvania, they're lazy. That's probably the answer.
Absolutely.
Well, one thing I will say, I didn't want to cut you off. But the Pro Tour, especially now in the modern era of the Pro Tour, the East Coast, especially the Northeast, is severely lacking in terms of opportunities to play, right? Like, now that MVP and GMC are playoff events, as a Pennsylvania disc golfer, I have to drive at least, not me anymore, but the Pennsylvania disc golfer has to drive at least 10 to 12 hours to play a disc golf Pro
Tour. Yeah, Idlewild is your next closest.
Correct.
I don't intend this to be a criticism of the Pro Tour, because they're doing what they feel is in their best interest, and mm-hmm. they often will have regional or week of qualifiers for events. But I think there's something lost in the health of the sport and the like regional aspiration when there isn't a legitimate opportunity to go play those.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at a map and you circle anywhere from Ohio and Maryland northeast, there are probably, I'm going to sound really dumb, but let's say 100 million people that live in that region of the country.
I don't think you're that far off.
It's a lot, right? I mean, you have New York City and Boston, notably, and a bunch of other big cities, Philadelphia. And there are zero, as of now, Pro Tours that a 1,010 rated player who could get into any Pro Tour they wanted, but in that region can get into.
Mm-hmm. Which meanwhile, we just spent a month in Texas.
Exactly.
Scheduling is difficult. The logistics for all of this are difficult. You can't just pop up a Pro Tour quality course that can accommodate the players, the spectators, the media, the parking, the everything. But it is a shame that there doesn't seem to be a path forward toward that. I can't really think of an A-tier in Pennsylvania or New York that seems to be moving in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, we had, you know, the formerly Delaware Disc Golf Challenge at Iron Hill, now called the Birdie Open, which is one of my favorites, if not my favorite tournament of the year. And they do a great job down there, Vince and his crew.
Do you have any thoughts on how players who are from Lancaster, or let's say an hour and a half around there, could optimize their training or tournament schedules in order to be better and like develop the skills that it takes to go play professionally?
That's a great question, because I'm trying to do the same for myself. But
you just go to Her Park and yeet hole two over and over and over again until you're throwing past it?
Yeah, I mean, that's not a bad strategy. One thing you can do, right? I mean, if you travel up to 4 hours, which I think is pretty doable for a weekend, you can get a pretty good variety of disc golf in terms of high level, right? Like we just mentioned, Iron Hill is a fantastic course for building your woods game and having to throw drivers in the woods, right? Which is
gaps maybe, with control.
Correct. Which is maybe a lost art on the Pro Tour, but still something that will always benefit you in your game. If you go to Pittsburgh, they have some great courses out there. The Pittsburgh Flying Disc Open every year, right? And you got to throw far on those courses too, right? North Boundary Park, right? I don't know if you played it. Uphill, downhill, some crazy shots. You need distance there too. So Failure Lake, obviously a great new addition to just the disc golf world. That property is super amazing. So I think, you know, if you're willing to travel a little bit, especially to get practical experience, right, at higher level courses, you can get it. If you stay in Lancaster, it's very easy to kind of fall into the trap of thinking you're improving your game overall when you're just getting really good at throwing these courses where you only need 300 to 330 feet of distance.
Yeah, you throw your 325 flex forehand and all of a sudden you can birdie 14 of the holes there.
Correct.
Ugh. And that skill can earn you pars on the Pro Tour.
Yeah, I have learned that firsthand. I've gotten a lot of pars the past couple of weeks. And, you know, the scrambling and, like, all those skills are very helpful, right? And there are at least 2 to 3 holes on every course where that 330-foot forehand is really helpful. At Jonesboro, I was probably 5 under on the 4 holes where I throw my 330-foot forehand.
The problem is, so is everybody else.
But so is everybody else, exactly. And I was probably 3 over in 3 rounds on the straight, you know, old hole one, right? Like the straight backhand that goes 460 feet. So, you know, those are the shots that are the separators, right? And you don't have to birdie that hole every time on the Pro Tour. Nobody is. Maybe Calvin is. I don't know.
Sure. All right. If you enjoyed this podcast and you want to lavish praise on me for it, you can find me on Instagram and whatever the fuck Twitter is at fish58320. And if you hated the podcast and you want to yell at them, tell them to get better, sucka. Where can people find you, Nathan?
You can yell at me on Instagram, at NathanJohnsonDG. It's the best place, and if you like hearing my voice, that would be a first, but I do a lot of commentary for Heiser Media's YouTube channel. They do some great tournament coverage on the East Coast.
And do you have any discs or other merch that people could buy to support you?
Currently, no, but if you check out Home Again Disc Golf, they're on Instagram. They have a website and a shop. We should have some fun things cooking soon. Hopefully some fundraiser discs from Infinite, one of my sponsors, should be coming up this summer. Should
okay.
be
good. And I need you to think quickly here. You ready?
No.
Ugh. Say a mean thing about Nathan Queen.
Why are all of the Nathans, Nathaniels, and Nates on tour so picky about what people call them? That's all I have
say
to
say something
know.
Mean about Nate Perkins.
I don't know. I Perks, he seems like a nice guy. This is tough.
Say I've only something played mean with him about twice. Nate Sexton.
I lost Sexton Firebird at a course in Lancaster, and they didn't give it back to me after.
Say something mean about Nate Hecker.
Never met him.
Say something mean about Nate Doss.
Nate Doss. The internet seems to hate his commentary, but I think he's fine.
Say something mean about Nathan Johnson.
The guy. Oh gosh, where do I start?
That's a wrap on this week's Fish Golf Broadcast. Join us next week to fritter away more of your ever-waning life force on two jabronis talking about Frisbee. Please support the show, if you're able, by shopping for fish stuff at fishdiscgolf.com, Daddy Disc Golf, Disc Hub, Tree Magnets, and Disc Golf Bra's websites. You can still save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10, and please tell a friend about this show. Unless you don't have any friends, but that's your problem, not mine.